got married and is now raising her family next door, including an 11-year-old son and 7-year-old daughter named Silwan. Ode lives in an extension to her family home that she and her husband built in 2017 to accommodate their growing family. The Zionist regime authorities refused to grant Ode the permits to construct the additional unit. And within a few weeks of building the extension, the authorities issued an order to destroy it or face a hefty fine. The Zionist regime authorities don't give Palestinians permit to build big houses, but we are witnessing in numbers, so we have to add rooms to the original buildings, but they won't even let us to do that, Ode said. Where else will we go? It's not humane. Around 1,500 residents spanning close to 100 buildings in Al-Bustan are facing displacement from demolition orders, according to Amy Cohen of Er Amim, an Israeli regime group that monitors settlement activity in Al-Quds. According to Cohen, 48 families submitted to request to extend a temporary demolition freeze, which has been extended until February 2022. Yet the freeze does not cover another 16 buildings in Al-Bustan facing imminent demolition. Following changes to planning laws introduced in 2017, the Zionist regime authorities can fast-track the demolition of Palestinian buildings in many cases. The authorities no longer require court orders for demolition since those changes came into effect. Amani Ode home is one of the 16 buildings in Al-Bustan facing imminent demolition by the Zionist regime authorities. Ode is blocked from having the case reviewed in court because of the 2017 amendment to the Zionist regime planning laws. The Rajabi family, owners of the butcher shop destroyed in June, are in the same situation. Their home could be destroyed at any moment. Demolitions in the neighborhood are part of a plan being advanced by the Israeli regime-controlled Al-Quds municipality and the settler group Ilad. Ilad's declared objective is to Judaize East Al-Quds so that a theme park named after the biblical character King David can be established. The City of David Park would serve to create this territorial contiguity with the area between the settlements and touristic enterprises, while at the same time eroding the fabric life in the community. The character of Silwan as a Palestinian neighborhood and a Palestinian presence in the area altogether, said Amy Cohen from the settlement monitoring group Er Amin. Residents in Al-Bustan received demolition orders in 2005 when the municipality first pushed for an evacuation of the area to make way for a tourist park called King David's Valley. The project was slightly repackaged in 2010 by a municipality plan known as the King Garden Plan, which designated Silwan as a mixed tourism housing area. Local and international presence may have slowed the implementation of the project since 2010, Cohen said. But this year's acceleration of demolitions might signal a revitalization of the project. Cohen told the Electronic Intifada, Palestinian communities are becoming more fragmented and pushed into smaller enclaves. The Zionist regime demolition of Palestinian property is illegal under international law. Situated on a slope just below the old city of Al-Quds, Silwan is the nucleus of Palestinian life in the occupied eastern part of the city. The neighborhood makes up a large portion of the so-called Holy Basin, which stretches from the Muslim and Christian quarters of the Old City to the Mount of Olives. The Zionist settlers used the term as a claim of religious significance for the area, a pretext to justify the theft of Palestinian land. Eilat has long targeted Silwan as part of its mission to expand Jewish presence across the city and to uproot the indigenous Palestinian population under the guise of archaeological and touristic endeavors. Demolitions in Silwan accelerated after the enactment of 2017 Kamenitz Law, an amendment to 1965 Planning and Building Law. The amendment was established for enforcement and penalization of planning and building offenses, according to Adala, an advocacy group for Palestinian citizens of Israel, but has denied a judicial process to Palestinians in Al-Bustan whose buildings are slated for demolition. The amendment is in keeping with a history of discriminatory housing policies under which Palestinians have been expelled from Al-Quds for decades. In 1973, the fake regime of Israel endorsed recommendations from the Interministerial Committee to examine the rate of development for Al-Quds, also known as Gafni Committee, to maintain a demographic imbalance in the city of a majority of 74% Jewish Israelis and 26% Palestinians. Israel's efforts to maintain this demographic imbalance and Judaize Al-Quds are implemented through a severely restrictive network of discriminatory zoning and planning policies, said Jeff Hapler, director of the Israel Committee Against House Demolitions. In 1976, the Zionist regime declared an area surrounding the Old City and its environs a national park, classifying residential areas of Silwan as green zones open for public planning and zoning. Apart from two projects, no other public planning outlines have been put forward for Palestinian neighborhoods in East Al-Quds. Only 13% of the land has been allocated for future construction of Palestinian neighborhoods, while 35% has been zoned for the expansion of Israeli settlements in East Al-Quds. Housing, zoning, planning are all very dry, complex bureaucratic language, but this is much more effective than the military means in terms of Judaizing the city, Hapler said. Israel can take over Silwan without raising too much international outcry because it is all done slowly under the radar, unquote. Such policies make it nearly impossible for Palestinians to obtain a building permit from the Al-Quds municipality, forcing residents to build illegally and risk home demolition. From 1991 to 2019, the Israeli regime-controlled Al-Quds municipality issued more than 21,000 permits for the construction of Jewish settlement units in East Al-Quds, while less than 10,000 were allotted for Palestinians. The number of structures demolished in East Al-Quds rose by 44% in June this year, compared with the previous 5 months. Illegal touristic endeavors in Silwan, pioneered by Eilat, also include excavations for the City of David Park project. The underground tunnels have left Palestinian homes in the area crumbling since they were first dug in 2000. Hapler, the director of the Committee Against Demolition, said, "Archaeology is part of the Judaization process also. You can dig and destroy all the layers until you get down to the ancient Israelite layer to show the tourists. In this way, they can erase all the Palestinian history down to the history Israel wants to highlight." The most recent demolitions in Silwan came after the municipality rejected new zoning plans put forth for the third time by residents. Fakhri Abu Diab, a prominent community activist in Silvan, told the Electronic Intifada. Residents worked with Yusuf Jabarin, an urban planning professor at Technion in Haifa, to develop a new outline for the neighborhood. Its purpose was to allow optimal space for development in order to accommodate a growing population, as per a spoken agreement with the municipality to extend the demolition freeze. The neighborhood collectively spent $500,000 on plans, Abu Diab said, putting forward a different design each time. When residents pressed the municipality on why the outlines continued to be rejected, they were only told that the ruling came from the Israeli regime's interior ministry. Abu Diab said, "This proves that the permits are just excuses. It is clearly a political situation." Zionist regime authorities are also threatening to demolish Abu Diab's home in Al Bustan, where his wife, 5 children, and 12 grandchildren live. The Israeli regime authorities denied Abu Diab building permits 7 times, forcing him to build a 2-room extension to his own home without Israeli permits. Despite the addition, living conditions are still cramped. "If you will go inside and look at it, it will look like a refugee camp with so many people. It's not enough room at all. But we have no other option," Abu Diab said. Abu Diab added, "Am I going to sleep in the streets just so they can build a garden over my house? Every day here we say this may be the last night sleeping in our homes. Israeli regime forces may come tomorrow and destroy it. If we don't do it ourselves, the municipality will charge us 1,000 shekels per meter of what they demolish." Since June 29th, Israeli regime forces have attacked Palestinians protesting the demolition with rubber-coated steel bullets and tear gas, injuring at least 19. In scenes reminiscent of the ongoing situation in adjacent neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah, where Israeli regime forces have continued to brutally police Palestinian residents protesting a complete takeover of their homes by settlers, Silvan was also declared a closed military zone on July 20th. The Zionist regime forces installed checkpoints on roads entering and exiting the neighborhood, further restricting freedom of movement for Palestinians in the city. Abu Diab told the Electronic Intifada, "The situation is very awful. Every day someone is arrested. Every day these are clashes. Police are giving fines, and every other day there is the sound of rubber bullets. I wouldn't let my kids go out after 7 p.m. because they may be arrested or shot. So desperate is the situation that Palestinians are demolishing their own homes to avoid being landed with a bill if the Zionist regime carried out the demolition." So far this year, 45% of demolitions have been carried out by their owners, a 27% increase from the previous 5 years. The increase has been attributed to new legislation that gives the Israeli regime controlled Al-Quds municipality the power to exert pressure on families to demolish their own structures, according to the UN Monitoring Group, OCHA. The Zionist regime has demolished and confiscated more than 670 Palestinian structures in the occupied West Bank since the beginning of the year, displacing nearly 1,000 people. Almost half of those displaced were children. This includes 116 structures in occupied Istanbul lots where more than 200 people have been displaced. Residents have engaged in public art projects in the neighborhood and communal dinners as another form of protest. Amani Ode also organizes weekly gatherings for youth activists. Ode held back tears as she told the teens at one such recent meeting, "There is an old folk tale that says Silvan is a well that you drink from and forget your heartbreak."
Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. As you know, our program aims to address the most significant issues in the subcontinent that affect the governments, communities, organizations and the region as a whole. We will try to explore and explain its geopolitics, untangle the arguments from different perspectives and make the alternative voices heard.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we are going to take a look at the US offer of humanitarian assistance to crisis-stricken Afghanistan and what it means in the context of America's 20-year-long adventurism. And we shall discuss a major crackdown by authorities in Indian-controlled Kashmir in response to recent killings of the members of minority community.
Reports suggest that the Biden administration has agreed to provide aid to Taliban-ruled Afghanistan, which is staring at a major humanitarian crisis. On the face of it, the gesture appears to be altruistic in nature, but on dissecting the issue, it becomes clear that the catastrophe itself has been manufactured by the US military-industrial complex. Even before Taliban's dramatic takeover in August, the country was grappling with economic recession, drought and the COVID crisis. And then came the freezing of assets and aid by the US and its European allies, which plunged the country into an unimaginable crisis.
In a classic case of manufacturing a crisis and then play-acting to resolve it, Americans have reportedly agreed to deliver financial aid to crisis-stricken Afghanistan, while refusing to politically recognize Taliban's caretaker government. It came after first direct talks between the two sides early October in Doha, nearly 2 months after the chaotic withdrawal of US troops from the war-ravaged country. While the US government has stopped short of officially announcing the aid, after two meetings with the Taliban officials, the European Union has pledged $1.5 billion in aid to Afghanistan and to neighboring countries, without specifying how it will reach the ordinary Afghans. It comes as decisions on whether to officially recognize the Taliban government and whether to unfreeze nearly $10 billion in Afghanistan's national assets held by the US Federal Reserve have been effectively put on the back burner. The US government blocked the access to Afghan assets immediately after the Taliban laid siege to Kabul on August 15th. 2 days later, the European Union also suspended its long-term projects in the country, leaving millions of Afghans at the risk of major humanitarian catastrophe. Since then, International Monetary Fund, as well as the World Bank, have stopped disbursing money to the country. UN Chief Antonio Guterres has warned of make-or-break moment for Afghanistan, with the economic institutions slowly breaking down. The US officials, however, remain indifferent to the crisis they helped create.
The full-blown humanitarian catastrophe in Afghanistan did not unfold overnight. It has been in the making since the US-led coalition forces invaded the country 20 years ago. On the pretext of nation-building, the foreign powers destroyed the country, fanned the flames of war, and eventually beat a hasty and humiliating retreat. Having failed to help Afghanistan become self-reliant over the past two decades, the US and its allies are now strangulating the country by freezing its assets. At the same time, it's hoodwinking the international community by making flimsy promises of humanitarian assistance.
Under the previous US-backed government in Kabul, around 43% of the South Asian country's GDP came from foreign aid, according to the World Bank. But still, as the former president Ashraf Ghani himself admitted in July 2020, 90% of the country's population lives below the poverty line, with less than $2 daily income. A report by the UN Office for Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs in January 2021 noted that around 18.4 million people in Afghanistan, nearly half of the population, were in need of humanitarian assistance, six times more than 4 years ago. These horrifying statistics were published before the Taliban made sweeping advances across the country, and at a time when the US-led coalition was firmly in control. So, the question everyone is asking is, what happened to the $2.26 trillion the US claims to have spent in Afghanistan since 2001? Did it vanish into thin air? Before the Americans and European froze Afghanistan's assets in August, they had for years enabled rampant corruption, filling the coffers of those who pledged loyalty to them. This gross misappropriation of funds was even acknowledged by the top US oversight body. So, the news about US or even Europeans offering aid to the country now should be taken with a grain of salt.
Now, to have more insights, we are joined by Mr. Ryan Dawson, an author and geopolitical analyst. Mr. Dawson, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me. It's very important.
Now, as we've seen, Americans and Europeans have pledged aid to crisis-stricken Afghanistan 2 months after hastily abandoning the country. Now, do you think this so-called assistance should be seen with a measure of skepticism?
Well, certainly it prudent would show that there should be skepticism toward this aid. And this has been ongoing even before the invasion of Afghanistan in 2001. All throughout the 80s, the United States had intervened in Afghanistan allegedly to fight the Soviets, and they had aided different factions, and there's never any result from this aid. And they used it as a bargaining chip. They used food aid, for example, which they would take away if they didn't get the political results that they wanted. And so this aid doesn't come without consequences. Hillary Clinton is infamous for cutting off food aid, which forced factions in Afghanistan to start selling opium again out of desperation, which led to more drug cartels and various things. Of course, during the occupation of Afghanistan, and that's what it was, when they annexed it for 20 years, the U.S. was protecting poppy fields. But that revenue didn't go back to Afghanistan. That revenue went to intelligence agencies, and which was used as black budgets to finance terrorist groups like ISIS in Syria.
Now, Mr. Dawson, it was the U.S. government that initiated the talks with the Taliban last year without taking the Kabul government on board. So why is Washington now justified in freezing $10 billion U.S. dollars of Afghan assets?
Yeah, I mean, that wasn't part of the negotiations. Of course, there's different administrations. So the Trump government sat down and had negotiations with the Taliban. And the Taliban did stop attacks on U.S. targets, and the U.S. stopped attacking the Taliban. So there was peace in Afghanistan so long as people upheld the agreement. Nowhere was it said, oh, later after we leave, we're going to freeze all your assets because you're not the government we really want. We were hoping the Afghan nationals that we were supporting were going to... It shouldn't be up to the United States to decide which government is in Afghanistan or not, first of all. It's not up to an outside power. That's supposed to be up to the people of Afghanistan. And when it's not, even with their civil war, what have you, the U.S. cannot be picking winners and losers in this, which it tried to do. And for 20 years, they wasted trillions of dollars. Trillions with a T. Imagine if they spent a fraction of that on actually helping people in Afghanistan through charities or third parties, something that's not government. But that's not what happened. But they made a deal with the Taliban, and then the administrations did change. But I don't know if the old administration would have upheld the deal either. But as it is, the Biden admin comes in, reneges on the deals they made, and says, we're going to freeze $10 billion. Why do they even control that much is another question, but they're going to freeze their assets. Now, they can do it based on power and based on the bully pulpit, but if you're asking, can they do that? Yeah, they can. They have the ability to. Should they be allowed to do that? Of course not.
Mr. Dawson, one last question. Now Afghanistan is today staring at a humanitarian crisis or catastrophe. Do you think part of the blame should be shared by the U.S. and its European allies?
They are partly to blame. They left weapons caches out for whomever. And their behavior, first of all, is an act of terrorism when you take a drone and murder a family of 10. Which finally got a lot of news attention, the final drone strike that took out a family, mostly children. That is an act of terrorism, and it also creates acts of terrorism as a backlash. And the drone policy and much of the house raiding policy and the double tap policy that they kept for 20 years in Afghanistan, which mainly did kill civilians, and in my opinion is terrorism itself, it's high-tech terrorism, will beget terrorism as a response. People who didn't hate or even know about the United States before is going to hate them now. Weapons of mass destruction that we say no one else is allowed to have, but that are used, cluster bombs and napalm and MK-77 and MOABs that the military did deploy in Afghanistan at some points, they kill indiscriminately. And they had very bad intelligence where, you know, one tribe would say, yeah, that's the bad guys over there, and it's just their own personal enemies, and the U.S. would run around, attack that one, and then, oh, oops, and then rinse and repeat. And then they had lots of green-on-blue attacks, too. They need to just... They don't have the intelligence that was proven, so they can't do a good job of this. They engaged in acts of terrorism, whether they meant to or not. You know, if you drone strike the wrong car and end up killing a family because you got bad intel, it doesn't matter to that family. And let's be honest, this is not just all incompetency. You do that a few times in the first year, you need to sort that out. And they never did. For a generation, they murdered people over there. So that is terrorism. And of course, it's going to create terrorists. But in their minds, they won't think of themselves as terrorists. They'll think of, I'm avenging my family. Well, certainly they've had a role in the humanitarian crisis. I mean, they supported drug lords selling opium, who became the little fiefdoms in their valleys, not the best people to be in charge. And a lot of the healing that Afghanistan may have been able to do has been impossible because they've been in perpetual war for the last 30 years, really, including the Soviet occupations and then the U.S. occupation. That cycle of violence prevents the things that may have occurred in peacetime.
Mr. Dawson, thank you for being on the program. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media and cyberspace on this issue.
Medea Benjamin, author and founder of Code Pink, warns that if the US and World Bank do not release frozen Afghan funds, people in the crisis-stricken country will starve. Entrepreneur and freelance translator Noor Ahmed says $1 billion in aid cannot be a substitute for nearly $10 billion assets frozen by the US, demanding release of the money. Steve Hank, economist at Johns Hopkins University, points to corruption in Afghanistan fueled by foreign aid, says the country is at the brink of collapse despite billions of dollars in funding.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
The situation continues to be fragile in the Indian-administered Kashmir after a fresh crackdown by the Indian security forces in early October, detaining over 700 people. It came in response to the killing of seven civilians, four of them members of the minority Hindu and Sikh communities. The cold-blooded killings have sparked anger and outrage across the Himalayan region, with the majority Muslim community unequivocally condemning it. However, many believe the police action against the members of the community smacks of abuse of power.
The summer capital of the Indian-administered Kashmir, Srinagar, was rocked by three back-to-back killings on October 5th. The first attack targeted a well-known pharmacist from the minority Kashmiri Hindu community. The second attack resulted in the killing of a non-local Hindu street hawker. The third attack killed a Muslim civilian. Barely 2 days later, unidentified gunmen barged inside a government school on the city outskirts, killing two teachers, a Sikh and a Hindu. In a separate but similar incident, two Muslim civilians were also shot dead. The spate of killings has sent shockwaves across the Himalayan Valley and sparked fear and unease among the minority communities. However, despite leading the condemnations, members of the majority Muslim community are again under the scanner. A massive crackdown by the Indian police has resulted in the arrest of around 700 people, mostly Muslims. The families of those arrested say the authorities are looking for scapegoats to hide their inability to protect the religious minorities. The sweeping action against local Kashmiri Muslims is seen as part of the controversial policy adopted by the BJP government in New Delhi since the abrogation of region's semi-autonomy status in August 2019. Pertinently, the attacks were claimed by a little-known group allegedly affiliated with the Pakistan-based militant outfit Lashkar-e-Toiba.
Following the revocation of Kashmir's special status under the Indian Constitution on August 5, 2019, New Delhi peddled a narrative of peace and normalcy, claiming that tourism has replaced terrorism in the troubled valley. But nothing could be farther from the truth. In the past 2 years, since 2019, not only have incidents of terrorism seen an alarming surge, authorities have used stringent measures to stifle dissent, detain political activists, intimidate journalists, and prevent political activities. In the process, the majority Muslim community has borne the brunt.
On August 4, 2019, close to 6,000 Kashmiri politicians, activists, journalists, and ordinary youth were arrested, internet was suspended, and a blanket curfew was imposed. It was a precursor to measures taken the next day when the disputed region's semi-autonomy status was revoked and the state was bifurcated into two union territories. The region remained under a communications lockdown for more than a year, even as unrest was quietly brewing. India's far-right BJP government claimed that peace and normalcy has returned, while rights activists decried arbitrary arrests of activists, silencing of journalists, and draconian colonial-era laws for critical social media posts. 2 years on, arbitrary detentions continue, public assembly is still banned, and thousands of youth remain in jails, including minors. Social media vigilantism has led to dismissal of dozens of government employees, while critical reportage by journalists has got them summons and arrests under repressive laws. While Kashmiri Muslims have borne the brunt of Indian government's post-August 2019 Kashmir policy, they have also been turned into scapegoats for security failures. The detention of over 700 Kashmiri Muslims 2 weeks ago and killing of a Muslim youth in South Kashmir this week, apparently in response to recent civilian killings, follows the same disturbing trend that has somehow been normalized now.
Now, to have more insight on the situation in Kashmir, we are joined by Mr. Zafar Khan, the head of diplomatic affairs at Jammu Kashmir Liberation Front. First of all, welcome to the program, Mr. Khan. Now, there has been a spate of killings of members of minority Hindu and Sikh communities in Kashmir. Now, do you think it's designed to disrupt the centuries-old tradition of communal harmony and religious syncretism in the region?
Hello. One has to, first of all, condemn this because it is an absolutely not in the interest of the Kashmiri people or the struggle for the right of self-determination in the wider context of the Kashmir issue, Kashmir dispute, Kashmir conflict. This is a some kind of orchestrated, sinister move that can be attributed only to those who are in power in the state of Jammu and Kashmir, and particularly in Indian occupied Kashmir. You have something like 900,000 military and paramilitary forces who have practically over the past 2 years laid siege to at least 90% of the population of the Indian occupied Kashmir of state of Jammu and Kashmir. And let's not forget, Kashmir since the 5th of August 2019 has been bifurcated and is directly ruled from New Delhi. There is no local rule in the state of Jammu and Kashmir for almost 26 months now, just over 26 months.
Now, Mr. Khan, in a major crackdown, hundreds of Kashmiri Muslims have been detained in connection with the recent killings. Now, do you agree that the security agencies are looking for a scapegoat?
Of course, there is no legal or moral justification to the Indian government, this government or previous governments, to actually deny the existence and the bona fides of the struggle to right to self-determination in Jammu and Kashmir, because there are around 24 UN resolutions and UN charter demands that the right of the people of Kashmir is sacrosanct, and that the Kashmiri people have yet to decide on the future status of their homeland, and therefore the Indian state in particular, and in the wider context, those who are occupying the state of Jammu and Kashmir are always looking for excuses and scapegoats. And indeed, the communal dimension of this killing does not serve the interest of the people of state of Jammu and Kashmir, and therefore it has to actually be the answers need to be looked at the occupying forces, the occupying authority, the state that has the power and overwhelming power, unprecedented military occupation in the state of Jammu and Kashmir under Indian occupation is something that cannot be ignored at all.
Mr. Khan, the BJP government in New Delhi claims that the abrogation of Article 370 will bring peace and development to Kashmir. So how do you assess the situation in the region 2 years down the line?
Well, in 1949, Article 370 was included or created within the Indian Constitution by the Indian state with agreement with the government of Jammu and Kashmir at that time. And the agreement was that India was only responsible for three areas, defense, foreign affairs, and communications. And India has since then actually ingressed into Kashmir and slowly occupied Kashmir and assimilated Kashmir. And abrogation of Article 370 means that since 5th of August 2019, Jammu Kashmir is an independent country occupied or reoccupied by a foreign power. And in clear contradiction of around 24 UN resolutions and also in agreements both between the Kashmiris and Indian state, which was engaged in temporary relationship, and between India and Pakistan. So therefore, India stands a state which is accused of breaking all the rules and all the agreements that it had willingly entered into at the international level and also in the region, and also bilaterally between the Kashmiris and the Indian state over the past 74-75 years. And therefore, there is no justification whatsoever of the Indian state that it is a matter that it is internal to Indian state. It is not. It is an international issue, and so the excuses from time to time that come from New Delhi is just to reinforce its false and fallacious and also malicious policies against the Kashmiri people.
On that note, I would like to thank Mr. Khan for his precious time, knowledge, and insight. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media and cyberspace.
India's Congress Party politician Salman Nizami denounces mass arrests in Indian-controlled Kashmir over 7 civilian killings, noting that everyone is not a militant. Muhammad Junaid, political anthropologist, says nobody was arrested when Hindutva mobs lynched people in mainland India, while in Kashmir hundreds were arrested for murders committed by a few.
And that was our episode about the US trying to hoodwink the world through the flimsy promises of aid to Afghanistan and how people in Kashmir are living in fear after recent killings followed by a major crackdown. We shall meet again, same time, same day, next week. So till then, take care.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. Kwasi Kwarteng, Britain's business secretary, faces a legal challenge over a tax handout to oil and gas operators by campaigners. Paid to Pollute, a group of environmental organizations, says that the taxpayer handouts to oil and gas companies are unlawful because they conflict with the UK's legal duty to achieve net zero emissions by 2050. We now present you an article written by John Ungood Thomas under the heading Shell and BP paid zero tax on North Sea gas and oil for 3 years. The article has been published by The Observer. Shell and BP, which together produce more than 1.7 billion tons of greenhouse gases a year, have not paid any corporation tax on oil and gas production in the North Sea for the last 3 years. Company filings reveal the oil giants, which have an annual global footprint of greenhouse gases more than five times bigger than Britain's, are benefiting from billions of pounds of tax breaks and reliefs for oil and gas production. According to annual payments to governments report analyzed by The Observer, Shell and BP paid no corporation tax or production levies on North Sea oil operations between 2018 and 2020, and claimed tax relief of nearly £400 million. Over the same three-year period from 2018, 2019 and 2020, they paid shareholders more than £44 billion in dividends. A petroleum revenue tax of 35% was effectively scrapped by the then UK Chancellor of the Exchequer, George Osborne, in 2016. And oil giants can claim billions of pounds in taxpayer handouts for decommissioning rigs. The North Sea is now one of the most profitable areas in the world for oil and gas production, after tax cuts by the British government to purportedly encourage oil and gas production. Shell and BP have set targets to achieve net zero carbon emissions by 2050 by investing in cleaner energy, but claim that the United Kingdom will continue to need oil and gas from the North Sea, which also supports thousands of jobs. Climate campaigners, however, are now challenging the UK tax regime in a High Court case. They want the payouts to be scrapped and a ban on any new oil and gas projects in the North Sea to help cut carbon emissions. Philip Evans, oil and gas campaigner for Greenpeace UK, says it's outrageous that as the United Kingdom prepares to host global climate talks, COP26 in Glasgow, we still have one of the lowest effective tax rates in the world for oil extraction. We're giving tax breaks worth billions of pounds to companies that have been fueling the climate emergency for decades. There are about 180 oil rigs in the North Sea, and the sector has generated about £360 billion in net tax revenues since 1970, which is about £7.2 billion a year. The United Kingdom has some of the lowest oil tax rates in the world. An analysis by research company Rystad Energy in January found that Britain is now the most profitable company in the world for the development of oil and gas mega projects. Taxpayers will foot a bill of more than £18 billion for the decommissioning of the oil and gas infrastructure in the North Sea up to 2065, made up of tax repayments and a reduction in offshore corporation tax. Campaigners want the handouts to be scrapped altogether and used to invest in clean energy. Kwasi Kwarteng, Britain's business secretary, faces a legal challenge over the tax handout to oil and gas operators by campaigners. Paid to Pollute, a group of environmental organizations, says that the British taxpayer handouts to oil and gas companies are unlawful because they conflict with the United Kingdom's legal duty to achieve net zero carbon emissions by 2050. A judicial review is due to be heard before the end of the year. Gabriel Jaliaskov, a campaigner at Platform, a UK group that investigates the social and environmental effects of the global oil industry and is supporting the legal case, said, "The government has spent too long backing oil giants through tax breaks and subsidies. It has had devastating consequences for the climate." Oil giants Shell and BP also face strong opposition over new projects in the North Sea. A report published recently by Friends of the Earth and the New Economics Foundation found that the oil and gas industry is preparing to seek approval for 30 offshore projects by 2025. Shell has defended plans for the Cambo project, a controversial oil field off the Shetland Islands that contains about 800 million barrels of oil, and is awaiting approval from the Oil and Gas Authority, a government licensing body. Greenpeace lost a legal bid recently for the government to revoke the permit for BP to drill at the Vorlich oil field in the North Sea, which started production in November of last year. It was reported by Reuters news agency recently that offshore petroleum regulator for environment and decommissioning had rejected Shell's plans to develop the Jackdaw gas field in the North Sea after considering its environmental statement. A Shell spokesperson said, our total oil production already peaked in 2019 and we expect it to continue to decline, including through divestments. We're already investing billions of dollars in low carbon energy. The North Sea transition deal agreed earlier this year also maps out how the sector will reduce emissions in line with the government's net zero targets. The company said it paid no corporation tax on North Sea production last year because of tax losses in previous years. A BP spokesperson said all BP's North Sea assets are owned by companies that are subject to British tax in accordance with British laws. Over the years, BP has contributed over £40 billion in taxes to the UK government from its North Sea business. The spokesperson added, in recent years, in line with long-standing UK tax regulations, tax relief on the significant investments we have recently made in the North Sea business and the challenging price environment, including the steep oil price falls in 2015 and in 2020, have meant we have paid no North Sea corporate taxes. A British government spokesperson said the UK oil and gas industry has paid around £375 billion in production taxes to date, with companies in the North Sea subject to headline rates that are more than double those paid by other businesses. Relief for decommissioning costs is a fundamental part of the British tax system.
Economic divide.
What in the world is going on with the world's energy commodities? Why is there such an energy crunch? Like for gas, why are oil prices so high? And if there's such a shortage, why are countries like Iran and Venezuela, who have two of the world's largest oil and gas reserves, restricted by U.S. sanctions? Hi, I'm Kavit Hathaway. Those are some of the topics we'll be covering in this edition of the program. Coming up in today's program, the energy crunch from the west to the east. Natural gas prices have skyrocketed in Europe, especially the UK, pressuring manufacturers in the US, Europe, and yes, even China. Then let's look at the green energy transformation. Is the world ready for it, transitioning from sources like coal to green energy? Is failing with coal actually making a comeback? The supply is falling short. Also in this program, we'll be taking a look at Iran's proven oil and gas reserves, 137 billion barrels, 10% of the world's total. It can alleviate global fuel crisis, but wait, U.S. sanctions are preventing that, and such is the case with Venezuela. It's a worldwide energy crunch, and countries around the world are feeling the squeeze, like in the U.S.
It is, actually. It's a really big problem, because, I mean, gas prices are like about $4 now, and, I mean, if somebody makes about $10 an hour, I mean, it's a big problem for them to even fill up their gas tank, because it's like $60,
$65. The United States is contributing to the shortage by not allowing a lot of fracking, by not allowing building of pipeline, so it restricts the supply. If you restrict the supply, prices will be going up. So the United States does its part. It's not the overall most important part.
Even China is feeling the shortage. Affected by various factors, many regions in China have seen tight supply of electricity since September. The situation is grim for the UK, which has been plagued by gas shortages and Brexit woes. Fears of inflation have gripped the U.S., causing investors in Europe to be cautious, especially since the energy crisis is driving up the price of oil.
Ich könnte mir vorstellen, dass der Staat sagt, die hohen Strom- und Gaspreise, Ölpreise, die decken wir zum Teil ab. Wir nehmen also die Spitze raus. Wer finanziert das am Ende? Natürlich die EZB, gemäß ihrem Motto, einer zahlt bestimmt.
Worldwide, citizens are mad, since they are suffering from high prices and inflation as a result of energy shortages and supply chain disruptions.
Vous touchez 600, il y a des personnes âgées qui touchent 600, 700 euros de retraite, des handicapés qui touchent 900 euros. Et vous avez des mamans avec deux enfants.
Il faut travailler aussi pour gagner 200 euros par jour. Moi, personnellement, je loue cette voiture que je paye 100 euros. Alors, dans les 100 euros qui restent, je dois manger, je dois mettre du carburant. Donc, ça veut dire que je fais une journée de travail quoi, pour gagner 50 euros.
This transformation to clean energy is also creating a crisis, since the volume of energy does not match the demand side now that many economies are opening up after COVID. With energy prices of the U.S. skyrocketing, shortage of energy in Europe, and China experiencing a shortage as well, the world economic recovery remains in doubt. Unless countries like Iran and Venezuela enter the market and provide the much-needed oil and gas. But U.S. sanctions are preventing that from happening. Once again, U.S. sanctions are affecting citizens of countries worldwide, including its own citizens. One of the things that the world energy crunch can do is to derail the world economic recovery. And naturally, when the economy picks up, there will be more demand for energy. World oil prices can rise, which it has. It can boost oil demand by 500,000 barrels per day, and it could stoke inflation, which, again, it has, in commodities like food.
A warning Thursday from the International Energy Agency. The energy watchdog warns a global energy crunch is likely to boost global oil demand by 500,000 barrels per day. That's enough to stoke inflation and slow the economic recovery.
Well, the IMF has cut its global growth forecast, with one of the reasons being the world energy shortage.
The global recovery continues, but the momentum has weakened, hobbled by the pandemic. Overall, risks to economic prospects have increased, and policy trade-offs have become more complex. Now, compared to our July forecast, the global growth projection for this year has been revised down marginally to 5.9% and is unchanged for 2022 at 4.9%.
Well, joining us for this edition of the Q&A is Joe Quinn. He's the lead editor and researcher at SOT.net. He has written articles like his most recent one, Newsreel, Zero Carbon, Zero COVID, The Reckless and Extremist Ideologies at the Heart of the Government. All right, Joe, welcome. The world is facing an energy crunch as the supply of natural gas and coal and other energy sources have failed to adequately satisfy demand. Natural gas prices have risen multifold, as you're aware, while several factories in China even have shut down due to power disruptions. What exactly is going on here?